This morning, we'll be having another conversation with one of the candidates who will be competing in the primary this March here in Illinois to represent their party in the general election for U.S. Senate here from Illinois. One of our senators, Republican Peter Fitzgerald, has decided that he's not going to run again. And we have a crowded field with 7 Democrats and 8 Republicans who all would like to replace him. We invited all of them to be on this program, and I'm a little sorry to say that this is the last of the scheduled interviews we have with candidates. We've had 4 of the 7 Democrats and now 3 of the 8 Republicans. Our guest this morning is Jonathan Wright. Let me tell you a little bit more about him. He currently serves as Assistant State's Attorney for Logan County, Illinois. His home is in Lincoln. He has served in the state legislature in the Illinois House. He also has worked in the Springfield office of the Illinois Attorney General. He's a graduate of Chicago Kent College of Law and also of Monmouth College in Monmouth, Illinois. As we talk this morning with Jonathan Wright, of course, questions are welcome. The idea behind these programs is so that potential voters can ask questions. Reporters get to talk with candidates all the time. But here's your chance to ask whatever question you want, whatever issue is really important to you. You can just pick up the telephone and you'll have the opportunity to talk with the candidate. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means no matter where you are in Illinois, if it would be a long-distance call, you can use the toll-free line and the call's on us. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Wright, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It's good to be a part of your program.
Well, I believe you have the distinction of being the only candidate out of all of these 15 who is a downstater.
That's correct. I'm the only one who resides south of Interstate 80. Hmm.
So tell me, why you want to run for the Senate?
Well, part of the reason I decided to do it was forged in my experience as a state representative. Certainly when I heard Peter Fitzgerald was not going to seek re-election, my first thought was not to run for U.S. Senate. But as I began thinking about it and other people that knew me both in Springfield and in my community started suggesting it, I looked at it more seriously. And I think it's time for someone who's going to bring an honest approach back to the campaign process, someone who's not necessarily a self-funded millionaire that I think, frankly, turns off a lot of voters to the process, and someone who's going to try to bring some change to government. We always hear the rhetoric on both sides of the aisle, but very rarely do we see those actions carried out once they get elected. And I think I have a record of standing on those issues and following through.
We have a caller already, so I guess we could go ahead and rather than make them wait, talk with them.
Absolutely.
On our line number 1 right here. Hello. Is a caller there, line 1? Hello? Well, maybe either they changed their mind or we haven't got all of our buttons pushed correctly. We want to try one more time? No. Okay. Well, in any case, if there are people who are listening who want to call in, again, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. When we get some people ready to go here, and we may get that first caller straightened out. Okay, we're going to try again. We have a caller here in Urbana.
Bring
on line 1. Hello. Is the caller there on line 1? Well, maybe we... Oh, yes, ma'am. Hello?
Hello. Good morning.
Yes, go ahead. Yes.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Wright. Thank you for being on the program this morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Okay. I have 2 questions for you. The first one is, I was hoping you could discuss the environmental issues that are important to you.
I'll be glad to do that. The environmental issues are important as I think we start looking at new energy sources. And I think as we're getting into this issue, we're becoming more aware that we not only need to reduce our dependence upon foreign oil, but we need to reduce our dependence upon oil. There is a finite supply of oil out there, aside from whatever ramifications it may have on the environment. Oftentimes they talk about new findings of oil reserves. They've not found any new oil reserves in years. We're just now able to access oil reserves we couldn't before. And so I think we need to start looking at hydrogen seriously as an alternative fuel source. And I think that's really the way we're headed, and I think we just need to get serious about it in terms of how we fund those sources. And then funding different sources in the meantime, whether that be ethanol that I think burns cleaner, or even some other opportunities we may have between now and the time that hydrogen becomes a reality.
Okay. And the second question was, I was hoping you could discuss your views on developing alternative modes of transportation like cycling, walking, mass transit, and quality rail service, and how you would, what kinds of legislation you might try to propose to encourage other modes of transportation.
Well, in terms of cycling and walking, I don't know that legislatively we can do too much. And I know it might be easy to make promises, but I'm trying to be honest in my campaign approach. I don't know that you can do a whole lot legislatively to encourage cycling and walking. I think we can try to look at alternative fuels that burn cleaner. I think public transportation, although that tends to be at a local level when you get into different communities, are important. And I think a lot of communities do have it. I think, frankly, where it struggles is in the smaller communities. You know, Chicago and even Peoria and Springfield have good public transportation systems, but you get into smaller areas and they just don't have that ability to be able to do that. So as we look at funding for transportation, I think we need to give as much creativity to the state and local governments as we can, and frankly need to do a lot more block granting to those areas for transportation than to try to make a one-size-fits-all answer in Washington.
Well, I would like to take you up on one thing that you said.
Yes.
You said that there's not too much that can be done legislatively to encourage cycling and walking, but there are actually things that can be done that do encourage cycling and walking that are very difficult for individuals to do. The way that we construct our built environment has a large impact on people's transportation choices. And a lot of that, I think, could be done legislatively, encouraging wider right lanes so that cyclists feel more comfortable riding, encouraging sidewalks, and just the way that we build our cities so that people feel that they can get around in a safe way without using their car.
Well, and I'm not opposed to those issues. I guess I would get back to the issue that as a federal U.S. senator, I'm not sure a U.S. senator is going to have a lot of direct say or impact on a lot of the local issues about sidewalks and the wider lanes. Certainly, federal transportation dollars are given to the states and locally even to some degree. And that's where I think it needs to be block granting so they have the flexibility to make those decisions. But in my understanding is the federal government typically does not get into a lot of those local decisions, nor do I think they should. But we ought to give the local level that flexibility.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank
you
for calling.
Thanks for the call. Let me ask you a question and give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about the economy, since that appears to be perhaps the number one issue. I think probably once we get around to having a presidential contest, people will be spending a lot of time talking about that. While things last year started to look up a bit, the economy is not as robust as certainly anybody would like. One of the things that Democrats have pointed out is the number of jobs that have been lost over the time that Mr. Bush has been the president, and we're adding back some jobs, but nothing like at the rate that we have lost them. So we come down to the issue of what, if anything, the government, the federal government, can do to stimulate the economy and encourage the creation of jobs.
Well, and I think that's an important question because ultimately the federal government is limited. I think we can create a climate that's conducive to jobs, but we're not going to create jobs in Washington apart from bureaucracy. Ultimately, the biggest vote that will be cast will not be cast in March or November. It's cast every day when people make their shopping decisions and where they spend their dollars. And if the American consumer wants the cheapest product, period, there's going to be little the federal government can do to stave off the loss of jobs. So ultimately, the American consumer casts the most important vote. Now, having said that, I think how we work our tax code is important in terms of making a jobs healthy climate. I think we need to look at health insurance. Most jobs in not only the state of Illinois, but in our country are small business employers, and they are finding it harder and harder, if not impossible, to deal with this issue of health insurance, not only for themselves, but their employees. Mm. And so I think we need to tackle the issue of health insurance. And then I think we need to really look at, is our economy changing in a permanent way, much like we did in the Industrial Revolution? Now, I'm not suggesting it'll be that significant, but our economy is going through some permanent changes. The jobs that we've lost in the last 10 to 12 years are not jobs we're typically going to get back. If you look at the history of some of the cycles of our economy, we've had times where we've lost jobs, and then when the economy comes back, those jobs are reinstated and they hire back on. These jobs are moving and probably are going to be gone. So we have to look at how we stop that from happening, and I think part of it is to make ourselves competitive. It's going to be hard for us to compete with other countries in terms of wages, so I think we need to look at what we can offer. Transportation, certainly in manufacturing, is a critical issue. And if no one's aware of what's going on in Rochelle with their intermodal hub, it's an ingenious, creative way where they thought outside of the box, and they're actually bringing jobs back to their area because they looked at what assets they do have, and transportation was one of them.
The one thing that I think it's fair to say, the one thing that the president has proposed in along the way of economic stimulus is a tax cut.
Yes.
And the Congress did indeed pass a package of tax cuts, and that was perhaps when President Bush was running for election in the first place. That was one of the things that was on the top of his agenda. Now, the one thing about those tax cuts is that they have a built-in sunset, and if they're going to be made permanent, the Congress is going to have to do that. I am assuming, I guess, that if you were elected, you would vote to make those tax cuts permanent.
Yes, I would do so, and I think they have helped to try to jumpstart the economy back. Certainly, we'd all like to see the economy farther along than what it is, but I think it's headed in the right direction, and I think the tax cuts were helpful in that area. And I think the tax code is an important reason why we do lose a number of companies. You know, Governor Blagojevich has been very critical of offshore companies because they go to countries where the tax code is much more friendlier. Well, you know, one way we can deal with that is try to make our tax code a little bit more friendly, not only in the United States, but in Illinois as well, too.
I know that there are some candidates who believe that the government, the federal government, should do something to discourage companies from taking jobs here in the United States and relocating them in some other country. And they have the idea, and for different people maybe have different ways about approaching it, but that somehow that there ought to be some sort of penalty that's something that the Congress could address to take away some of the advantages a company might see in taking American jobs and exporting them. Do you think that that would be appropriate, there any way that would be appropriate?
I've not seen any specific proposals on that, and certainly I would want to see any specifics, but I think we get to the issue then, is it akin to a tariff, regardless of what we may call it, and not so much because tariff is a bad word, but because even today the World Trade Organization has issued sanctions to the United States because of what they perceive to be tax subsidies that gave American companies a benefit. And so how would that be perceived by the World Trade Organization, by other countries, and would we have other sanctions that would be passed on because of that? And then ultimately we get to the question of a business's freedom to be able to move. If we've created a disincentive for businesses to remain in this country, should we penalize them then for going to other countries where they've created incentives for them to come? I think the better response is not to penalize them, but to remove those disincentives.
We have a couple of other callers, and maybe I'll just introduce very quickly our guest. We're talking in this hour of Focus 580 with Jonathan Wright. He is a Republican, one of eight that will be competing in the March primary here in Illinois on March 16th, that will then go on and represent their party in the general election, running for the seat that's being vacated by Peter Fitzgerald in the United States Senate. There are a number of candidates. As I mentioned at the beginning, there are eight Republicans and there are seven Democrats, and some of them have been interested in here being on this program, and we're pleased that they could give us some of our time. Questions here are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Our next, both callers are in Urbana. Next is line number two. Hello.
Hello. I don't want to give the impression I'm trying to blindside you, but are you familiar with the congressional study that came out on hydrogen this morning?
I have heard bits and pieces of it. I haven't had a chance to go through it in detail. I know the president has commented on it, but I wouldn't claim to be an expert on it already.
Well, essentially, it's a finding that it will not be practical for probably about 50 years, that we have no way of containing hydrogen in a fuel tank. We need very basic research. Given this probability, do we need to both focus on fundamental research on hydrogen, but also on fuel conservation with existing technology and pollution controls?
Well, I think we need to have a two-pronged approach. I certainly understand, and when I talked about hydrogen, that's not something that's going to happen in the next year, 10 years, 15 years, although I had heard the term 20 years used, but I'll certainly defer to you. I haven't had a chance to go through it in detail. We do need to stay focused on looking at hydrogen and other sources long range. Part of the reason we're in the problem now is because we perhaps haven't had the long range vision we should have had in terms of alternative fuels. But having said that, I think we need to also look at what we can do between now and then. And ethanol, I think, is one way we can look at burning a cleaner fuel that is something we produce that reduces our dependency upon foreign oil. I think we need to look at a lot of technology that's also being developed for other resources we have. Coal is an unbelievable resource we have in this country. And there's a program called FutureGen that would actually trap a lot of the product from coal and it's burning underground in the coal mine after the coal is eradicated from the ground, and is some great technology. I know even in Logan County there's a possibility of some new clean burning technology that's going to put in for coal burning plants. So we need to look at those in the interim as ways we can burn efficiently and friendly to the environment that are resources that reduce our dependency on any foreign energy, whether it be oil or otherwise.
Thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Let's
Thank you for the call.
Let's go to another caller. This is also Urbana, and it is line number one. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I was interested in your response to the lady who was asking about things that might be done on a federal level to improve pedestrian and bike traffic locally or in, you know, urban settings. And I think that you're probably assuming a rather short-sighted position when you say the federal government can't do much, because if we look back about 30 years here at the University of Illinois, where a lot of work was done to change sidewalk design, door design, and so on to help disabled people navigate the campus and the near environs, and later these programs were translated into state and federal programs with the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's certainly the same possibility to improve, to engage federal dollars and federal incentives for pedestrian and bike traffic. And with a country that is going as obese as feature stories tell us weekly, almost daily, whatever we can do to get ourselves off of our fat backsides is not only an economy in the consumption of fossil fuels, not only a way of revivifying our central cities, which are rotting at the core, but a vital incentive to a healthier lifestyle. And I really think you're dismissing something that, or that you treated this lady's query rather dismissively in an area that's important to a lot of us.
Well, and I'm sorry you took it that way. I was really just trying to bring what I thought was an honest conversation to it.
You cannot deny that you said that you saw little possibility of federal action. What I'm saying is 30 years ago, if somebody had posed the same question to you about disabled people improving access to, or you know, of ordinary streets and doorways and public facilities as disabled people, your present answer would indicate a disposition to have said 30 years ago, oh no, the federal government shouldn't get involved with something like that. I hope you change your mind.
Well, and I appreciate that. I'm not changing what I said or backing away from it, but I do think there is a reality. The ADA was designed initially for accessibility, not necessarily to encourage more people to be walking and traveling. It was really an issue of,
well, I think
do those who are disabled have the ability to act?
My argument, I only presented the ADA as a humble but revolutionary instance of where federal government, in a very imaginative stretch, interested itself in projects that were piloted first at universities. And I don't see why This is such a stretch to say that pedestrian and bike traffic can't be handled by the federal government in much the same enlightened way. Well, listen, I've said my piece. Thank you.
Right. Thank you for calling.
We'll go on here. Next is another Urbana person. This is line number three. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
Hi. I have two questions for you.
Yes.
Okay. My first question is whether or not you oppose opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge up for oil drilling.
I don't oppose opening it up. I think is a short-term solution. It does provide us with an immediate need to reduce our dependency upon foreign oil. Now, to be consistent with what I said before, we need to reduce our dependency upon oil completely. But as a previous caller noted, we're still a number of years away from getting to some of those serious alternative fuel sources. I think the proposal that was made was an environmentally safe proposal, and I think it would have helped, at least in the immediate future, to reduce some of our dependency upon foreign oil.
Are you aware that there's only 6 months' worth of oil and that it would take 7 to 10 years to get that oil to the market?
Well, I'm aware it's not a perfect solution, but also if we don't get the oil from there, we have to get it from elsewhere. I think we have to be realistic and recognize that at least in the immediate future, we're still dependent upon oil. And having said that, we need to start tapping into whatever resources we can here domestically to try to access it.
Okay, my second question is, if George Bush is reelected next fall and the opportunity presents itself during his term for him to appoint a Supreme Court justice to the bench, on the basis of whether or not they were pro-choice or pro-life, if he appoints a pro-life judge, on that topic alone, would you support or oppose their confirmation process?
If the justice was pro-life, I would support their confirmation process. And I think certainly as a secondary answer, they would deserve a vote one way or another, but they would certainly get my support.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Right,
thanks for the call. Again, we'll continue, and I believe our next caller is in Champaign, I think, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. I think you. I also think you underestimate the federal capacity to change things in terms of transportation, especially I like your comment about Rochelle, but Champaign has no intermodal transportation facility to allow freight to be removed from modern type trains that go that take semi-trailers, and often they're short-based semi-trailers with no house attached, and those vehicles can be taken off and exchanged very quickly, and they can move around cities without utilizing a lot of oil between towns. You have federal railroad policies that can encourage that sort of process. You also have federal policies that are interim trail use, which allow trails to gather up corridors like between Danville and Bloomington in an interim basis and keep those corridors afloat for possible future and different styles of railroad. I wonder if you can say something about a little bit more about the intermodal freight situation as it comes to places like Champaign.
I'd be more than happy to address it, and I certainly won't claim to be an expert on it, but I think you bring out some legitimate issues that we need to be creative on in terms of dealing with transportation. In Rochelle specifically, at that particular site, the Union Pacific and the Burlington Northern cross at that site, and so someone there, I think, had a very creative idea to say, let's put an intermodal hub where products can be transferred either to the train or off the train to semi rather quickly and reduce a lot of the transportation costs. And I know they're already getting manufacturers who are wanting to relocate because their transportation costs will go down by at least $1 million a year because of less shipping that they have to do to get it to the rail specifically.
Yes, I'd also like to comment that I think small is beautiful, and I would not like to see some of these small petticoat lines pushed out of action by huge rail cars that can only run on very heavy-duty lines. So I'm gunning for something that is smaller and more traditional. And I think the federal policies and the finance that goes with grants for railroading and the like can encourage that sort of thing.
I agree, and I think that you're bringing up some excellent examples of how we need to be creative in how we approach this issue, and one of the ways may be looking at rail sources that would be other than the traditional heavy-duty rails, but would at least allow transportation between two sites of freight and make transportation more cost-effective, and also reduce a lot of the energy issues that we've been talking about in terms of the need for less fuel to be consumed in transporting those. So I think really we're only limited by our own imagination and creativity in these discussions, but we need to start discussing it.
Yes, I think that would reduce some congestions in cities where parking is a prime issue and where biking and hiking are also issues that have been mentioned to you already.
Right. I agree, and I don't, I'm not running because I think I have all the answers to deal with the transportation, but I am running because I think I can try to focus some of this discussion and try to address these needs.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. We'll go on to a caller here in Crystal Lake, Illinois, line number 4.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Business has gone overseas because they can get a slave wages there, whether it's Mexico or now China, to a great deal. And certainly the unions have been broken by getting overseas labor for slave wages. And also, I think the tax cuts are not really necessary because if a company is based in the United States and they produce overseas, they can say it's a U.S. product and they don't have to pay a tax for shipping into this country. And further, the other reason that the business goes overseas is really because
maybe we get to the guest
to certainly a lot of companies like Enron, they get tax havens overseas. They don't have to pay any tax. They put their money in banks in the Cayman Islands. Enron had 800 banks overseas. And also the bedrock of going overseas is that we always, including the United States, Germany, and Japan, for long kept the value of the dollar up so that the things were cheaper over there, and they kept the, and other countries had a devalued dollar, and now that consumption isn't so good, that the high value of the dollar has gone down, and I think that's purposely done to encourage overseas investment when you can get things cheaper produced over there.
Mm-hmm.
And on transportation, certainly you need mass transit in this day because even parking space is getting short. We're using up our good farmland and also emissions. The Republicans usually, I don't know what you're for, but they usually don't want fuel emission efficiency. They want high use of gasoline for cars like SUVs.
Well, let's you raised a whole lot of questions. I want to give the guest a chance to respond to some of what you've mentioned. Some of the things we've touched on before, but there were a few new points. Mr. Wright, you want to talk about any and all of that?
I'll do my best. She raised a lot of great issues, and I'll try to recall them as best I can. In terms of the tax code, I think there are a lot of things we can try to restructure. For example, in America, if you have a domestic corporation and they produce something that is sold in a foreign market, in terms of the income, they pay a tax here for not only what they generate domestically, they then pay a tax on what they sell on a foreign market here in America, and then they pay the tax in the foreign market for the income they generated there. So there's essentially three taxes they have to pay, whereas if they go to that foreign market, typically most other foreign countries don't tax them for what they earn overseas. And so there again, that's just one example, I think, of how we've created a disincentive for companies to remain here. In terms of the wages, I think you're right. We have a difficult time competing with those slave laborers and low wages. And I think that's where we really need to try to deal with the World Trade Organization, although I think it's failing miserably. China has been a part of the World Trade Organization for 18 months, and they have yet to address their slave labor issues. They've yet to address how they steal our intellectual property. Even though it's protected by our laws, they steal it and then produce it in mass quantities at that slave labor. And so, frankly, the World Trade Organization has not addressed it, and we need to address our role in the World Trade Organization. And lastly, you mentioned Enron. Getting back to the tax code, a big part of the reason Enron happened is because of the way we started taxing profits off of stocks. It used to be when the market was in its early stages, the value of the stock had little bearing on whether somebody made money off of it. It was all dividends, and it was driven by dividends. Then we started taxing those dividends, and so corporations then started to look for other ways to get it to their shareholders, and so they went with the value of the stock, which is a very vague issue in terms of what is the real value of a stock. And so dividends decreased, and we started to go to value of the stock and then buying it low and selling it high, and then it encouraged, unfortunately, a situation where you had some dishonest people manipulate the books to try to get a high stock value. I think what we need to do is get back to a dividend-oriented market where we don't get into these gray areas of what's the value of the stock.
We are moving into our last 20 minutes here on the program. We have some other callers and would certainly encourage anybody to call in. And again, I think I should probably introduce our guest. We're talking with Jonathan Wright. He is one of eight Republicans that will compete in the March 16th primary here in Illinois to represent their party in the race for the U.S. Senate. Pete Fitzgerald, Republican senator, is not running again. We have an open seat and a very large field of candidates, eight Republicans, seven Democrats, will be competing in the primary. Just a little bit more in terms of background about our guest. He is an attorney. He's a graduate of Chicago Kent College of Law. He worked in the Springfield office of the Illinois Attorney General. He also served in the General Assembly. He was state representative for the former 90th District in Illinois. This was from June of 2001 until January of 2003. Currently, he serves as Assistant State's Attorney for Logan County, and he makes his home in Lincoln. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Back again to a caller in, we're going to go to Belgium over by Danville, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. I'd like to direct your attention in a slightly different direction. The primary system that we're using with today is really tilted for those influence groups that may have enough money. Now, I'm not really referring to the primary that you're involved with, where it's a much more local, statewide situation. I'm referring to the federal primary system that we have, because at this point, we don't, in March the 16th, we're not going to vote for a presidential Democratic candidate, as it's already been decided for us in previous elections. Wouldn't it be much wiser to have much better representation if we did it all on one day throughout the nation?
I think that's an outstanding question. I think that's something that really needs to be considered seriously. I wouldn't want to go on record committing to it because I haven't seen all the pros and cons, but it certainly creates a situation where people don't go to the polls, because in Illinois they'll think, well, it's already decided, as you mentioned, and I'm not going to have any impact on it. And I think we need to be doing the opposite. We need to be creating as much interest and involvement in the process as we possibly can. And it will implicate our race, because I think we will have a lower voter turnout in this primary. And in a crowded field, when you have less people showing because they'll perceive the Democrat presidential candidacy is decided, it's uncontested on the Republican side, I think we will have a very low voter turnout. And you always hate to see that in our form of government when people aren't going to the polls and feeling like they have a real voice and say. And I think there's a lot of ways we need to address it. Number one, the timing of when we do our primary system. I don't agree with Peter Jennings on a lot of things, but he made a very interesting point last week when he said polls have really become a lazy way for media to address this issue, because we now do so many polls that there again people buy in to think, well, it's already taken care of. And going into Iowa, they thought it was between Howard Dean and Dick Gephardt. And that's what all the polls suggested. And so who knows how many people actually took part in that caucus system and in other primaries because they thought the polls had it won one way or another. So I think there's a lot of issues we need to address in our whole system to really try to create voter interest and turnout.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. The last poll that I saw, and of course, people, you can decide whether you may or may not believe in polls, that asked about the Senate, the primaries for the Senate here, said that among people, there were a lot of people who said they had not made up their mind. So I think one has to acknowledge that. There are a lot of people that are undecided. But of those people who expressed a preference for a candidate, as I recall it, the candidates who came out on top on both sides, Democrat and Republican, were those candidates who had the greatest personal financial resources to commit to the campaign and had been able to spend a lot of money on advertising. And I wonder what you think about campaign finance as it exists, and whether in fact that presents an unfair advantage if you have somebody who is a multimillionaire and decides that he will spend all the money he's got. That certainly puts someone like you, that doesn't have that kind of resources, and most of the other candidates don't, at a great disadvantage.
And that's a good point, because we get asked an awful lot about campaign finance reform. And the reality is, any campaign finance reform that flows out of Washington benefits somebody. As much as they may like to put a spin on it that it's entirely objective and it's a fair system, in this case, and campaign finance always benefits the incumbent, and number two, in this case, it benefits those who are personally wealthy. I think we really need to, what we need to address with campaign finance is open and honest reporting of where a person or a candidate is getting their money from, and not so much a concern with are they investing it from their own money or is it coming from others. If we have open and immediate disclosure of where a candidate receives funding, then people can make use of that resource and decide, all right, they're tied to these interest groups, and I'm not going to support that candidacy. In this case, I know they have what's called the Millionaire Amendment, and the $2,000 cap of contributions can increase if a candidate infuses a lot of their own money. But that, too, can be manipulated, because, frankly, a smart candidate would wait until the last 60 days to infuse a lot of that money, and therefore by the time the Millionaire Amendment was triggered, it would be too little too late to really have an impact for any of their opponents. So I think what we have right now, however well-intentioned it may have been, is not effective, and we just need to get to a point where it's open and fair and pretty close to immediate disclosure of where the funds are coming from, and then let people make their decision.
And you would not approve or favor any kind of public financing of campaigns?
No, I don't necessarily want to go to that route where we have just a finite pie, and because I think then you get into First Amendment implications of whether we can eliminate a person's ability to spend money, which is a form of apparently speech, is what the U.S. Supreme Court has called it, and whether they're now limited to how they want to spend their funds in terms of supporting a candidate. I think the issue with the funding of it isn't so much how much, but where it comes from. And what we need is disclosure so the public can be well informed to say they're getting their money from these interest groups or from this lobby group, and therefore I'll make my decision accordingly.
We have another caller here. The
Great.
Next is Atlanta, Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Interesting conversation, and it's good to hear it. I've got a little question. Right now, most politicians are pretty well centered on economic things for their campaign rotates around, which is, you know, justified considering the problems we've had in the last couple years with the economy. However, about a year ago in the Lehrer Report, one of the top Democratic spinmeisters was on there. He was a gentleman from Texas, and I'm sorry that I forget his name right now. And Jim Lehrer interviewed him at length, and at the end of the conversation, he asked him what he thought the most important issue facing the Democratic Party was, and I was kind of shocked at the answer because being a top politician, I didn't think this would ever come out of his mouth, but he said the environment. And, you know, that looks more at a long-term thing than our present economic thing, and I know the senator that you would like to replace is a very strong environmentalist, and I just wonder where you rank the environmental issues on your agenda, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call. I'll try to be as specific as I can on that question, although it was pretty broad. I certainly think we need to be strong with regard to the environment, not because the environment is something we worship in and of itself, but because we need to be good stewards of it. And obviously, if we're going to make use of the resources that we have around us, the only responsible way to do that is to be good stewards of it. Now, that probably may not be the best of answers, because that could probably be viewed as going in either direction. But I think we need to really focus on renewable resources, make sure we're protecting those resources and using them as wisely as we possibly can, getting the most out of it without limiting our ability to use it for future generations.
Well, again, I hope that it gets to the question of the caller.
I hope so, too. It was kind of a broad-based question, so it was a broad-based answer, but I hope he finds that satisfactory.
Mm, we have less than 15 minutes, and certainly though time for other questions. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Did you support President Bush on the war in Iraq?
Yes, I did. At the time, we went into Iraq, and I still do now. I think it's an important issue as we try to deal with not only a rogue country that's working towards weapons of mass destruction, and there's been plenty of proof that they've certainly had it in the past, and there's even proof now, although we can't find the smoking gun, that they were again working towards it for the immediate future. And I think we need to address those issues, the potential ties with Al-Qaeda, and I support the president and his courageousness for stepping forward and taking action.
The man who was leading the effort to find the weapons of mass destruction some time ago got a lot of attention because essentially he said he thought that there weren't any. The administration has said they intend to keep looking. I think for a lot of people, a bottom line question is, suppose that we never do find them. And it may be that they had the expertise and the intention, but did not, and the president in his State of the Union speech, not this year, but the year before the war, said very clearly he has the weapons, he has them now, he is willing to use them. If it turns out that, in fact, there were no weapons of mass destruction, do you think that matters in when one asks the question, was it the right thing to do to go in there or not?
Given that the assumption of that question, and I wouldn't be prepared to make that admission yet, but given that assumption of the question, I still say yes, because if they have the intention and they're actively working towards it and they have scientists who are working on those weapons of mass destruction, President Bush called this a preemptive strike, and everyone knew it was a preemptive strike. And obviously, it loses some of its preemptive nature if we also wait until they actually have them, although at the time we launched, we felt like they did have them, and I think we need to address our intelligence and how we gather intelligence to make sure that we don't have any failures in the future. But they were certainly on track to have it, and when you have a rogue nation like Iraq, I don't think we automatically should wait until they have it and then try to bargain and be in a position where if we attack, they can use them against us. So I would still support it. Clearly, there's enough information now that they were on a track for producing them, although they may or may not have actually had them in hand at the time we invaded Iraq.
Are you satisfied with what we're doing in terms of homeland security? And if the answer is no, what should we be doing that we are not?
I would say overall I'm satisfied. You know, it's kind of a difficult question because you always want to keep yourself sharp. And when you become too satisfied, that's when you let down your guard. So we need to keep looking for ways to improve. But I think the president and Secretary Ridge have done a very good job of trying to address some of these issues in terms of homeland security, in terms of trying to make sure there's a coordination of information. I think that's one of the most fundamental changes we had after 9/11, was coordinating the information between federal agencies, state agencies, and local agencies, and then making sure we have response teams in place if something were to happen. So I think we've done a good job. There's always room for improvement. I don't have any specific idea in mind now, but we always need to make ourselves better at whatever we do.
President Bush has proposed a program that would give illegal immigrants in the United States temporary worker status. Essentially, what we're talking about here is a guest worker program for the United States. If sponsored by employers, they could stay for 3 years, and people living outside the country could apply for this temporary status, but they couldn't bring their families, and it's not designed to make it any easier for these people to become citizens. Just the idea is that they would come here temporarily and they would work. This is just a proposal. It's just on the table, and of course, no telling what would happen to it if it managed to work its way through the Congress. But just based on what it is the president has said, what do you think of that idea?
I I applaud the president for bringing the issue out. You know, obviously not talking about illegal immigration is trying to talk about everything but the elephant in the room, so to speak. I think maybe the timing of it was in reverse. I think before we start addressing some type of program to deal with those illegal immigrants that are already here, we need to start working with the government of Mexico and securing our borders to stem the flow of illegal immigration. Because until that happens, if we say we will grant some type of legalization, and I understand he's not proposing full amnesty, but some type of legal status to illegal immigrants, it's counterproductive because it actually increases the amount of illegal immigration. And if you look at the statistics from the INS in the last couple of months since the president made this proposal, there has been a spike in the number of immigrants who are trying to come to our borders illegally. And so I think first what we need to do is work with securing our borders a little bit better, work with the Mexican government to try to help them address this internally so there's not as much pressure for them to leave Mexico. And then once we've done that, then we can be in a position to say, how do we then best address the situation with the number of illegal immigrants we have in this country?
We have another caller. Let's talk with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. What are your thoughts on what's going on in Haiti? Do you think the administration did the right thing down there? And if not, do you think there might have been another way to have handled it?
Well, I appreciate the call and the question. I think the administration handled it appropriately rather than getting in too quickly. We waited to see what the situation was. We did send some in troops to make sure we guarded our own embassy and our own citizens. And now we're sending a larger contingency that has international backing. I think it had to come to a point where Aristide had to step away from that government, and really we needed to then allow them the ability to maintain some security and try to get the Democrat process moving forward again. So I think the president handled it well as it can be handled under very difficult circumstances. You always hate to read about the loss of life that occurs, but obviously the Haiti people are the ones that need to make some determinations on where they need to go as a country.
Well, I thought the Haitians had actually elected Aristide.
They had elected Aristide, but then the question is, and I think Secretary Powell addressed this in some of his comments this morning, that Aristide was then not really running much of a Democrat process once he got the vote. And, of course, we can't assume that we're comparing apples and oranges when we talk about voting, because it's not exactly like it is in America in terms of how the government then handles itself since then. And you had a large number of people who really felt like Aristide was running the government in anything but a Democratic process. And they were not having a voice, and they were not having a say, and the people were literally starving in some parts of that country. So they felt, as unfortunate as it is, the only way they could address it was to bring violence to the table. Now, no one encourages that or wants that, but obviously Aristide had made some policy decisions that forced people to do probably what they wanted to do least of all.
Well, if we're having difficulty with democracy just 200 miles away, what kind of odds would you give democracy working in Iraq, for example?
Well, Iraq is going to be a rough road. We've had a lot of years for our own country to develop, and even before we had our Constitution, we had freedom in many respects, just practically speaking, set aside the legality of it in this country in terms of being so distant from Great Britain or England. So it's going to be a rough road because we're infusing a new concept into Iraq. Now, that's not to say we still shouldn't forge ahead and pursue it, but I don't think we can try to look at this through rose-colored glasses to say now that they have a temporary form of government established that in a year everything will be wonderful. It's going to be a tough road, and that's why I think we need to stay committed to helping them through this process.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
We have a couple minutes left. I want to perhaps ask at least about one other area, and that's education. The president, one of the things that he said when he was running was that he was very concerned about the quality of education in this country. And so ultimately what happened was he proposed and the Congress passed this legislation that's come to be called No Child Left Behind. And the idea is that that there should be accountability and schools are required to set standards and then test and then demonstrate whether or not they have met those standards. And then funding is contingent on their being able to demonstrate that. It's proven fairly controversial, and now actually around the country there are places where schools are actually talking about opting out, saying, fine, we're not going to go down that road. What are your thoughts about No Child Left Behind?
Well, I didn't support No Child Left Behind when Senator Kennedy introduced it in the Senate, nor when the President signed it. I think we need to make some fundamental changes in education. I don't think standardized testing is necessarily the way to go. Even within the academic field, there's even those who dispute the validity and purposefulness of standardized testing. And I think when you talk a lot of teachers, it's a problem because they have to break their curriculum and then spend 4 to 6 weeks teaching for the standardized test just to make sure that the school can retain its funding. And then you have this uncertainty thrust upon in the middle of the curriculum with the standardized testing. And I think the issue of accountability also comes a little too late. You know, a school has to have gotten, has bottomed out really on their standards before accountability is infused into the scenario. And my concern is then, do we sacrifice 4, 5, 6 generations of students while the school is going down in terms of their standards? Before we allow the parents to have some measure of say as to where their children go. And then we've got to address the notion of, is there the ability for other schools to absorb these students? In Chicago, there's a couple of schools where the students now qualify to choose other schools, and there's a waiting list. They have no place to go. I mean, it sounds great to say, well, we'll let them go to other schools, but the other schools don't have the ability to absorb those students into their system.
Well, you know, we've used our time. We're going to have to leave it at that with our thanks. Mr. Wright, we want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time today.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed being on the program. Excellent calls and a good exchange of ideas, and that's what sets our system apart from every other system in the world. So I'm privileged to take part in it, and thank you for the opportunity to be here.
All right. Jonathan Wright, he is one of 8 Republicans that will be competing in the March 16th primary, and one of them go on to represent their party in the general election for the U.S. Senate. This is for the seat that's now held by Peter Fitzgerald.